is another week with the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. Dan, how you doing?
Doing all right. It's a beautiful sunny day out there.
If you're a new listener, I'm Scott May. I don't know how many people we pick up on a week-to-week basis. I'm not good with the internet algorithmic analyzation. I don't understand how people like know that stuff instinctually. Like,
well, how do we know that you're not AI? You could not, you could maybe you're just.
Oh man, I would be the worst AI ever. If they created an AI to not know the most things and just say, I'll get back to you on that, then I would be a supremely useful AI. Today, we are going to be talking about a subject that you had brought up to me that just made me 100% excited the second I heard you start to talk about it, which is sort of, you know, an umbrella philosophy for how you view brewing and beer. And when you were telling me about this, you were starting to talk a lot about historical events for why things are the way they are in brewing, why German beer tastes the way it does, why Czech beer tastes the way it does, why American beer tastes the way it does, why people get so dogmatic about these things, but also just an overarching sort of linchpin in your just philosophy and how you brew beer and how you view it. And that just got me really excited, because whenever we can crack a beer and start talking the philosophy of anything, I become a very, very happy person. So I guess my first question to you is, when did you first start thinking about beer as a concept just beyond just the, holy crap, I got to make this thing now and make it as good as I can, but as sort of how it, trying to piece together your view of how it all sort of operates together in its history?
Well, I grew up in the heyday of American style lagers. My father drank Olympia, which is, you know, pale American lager beer. And so all beers were pretty much like that. And when we were first married in the early 80s, Deb bought me a Michael Jackson book, not the musician, but the beer writer, famous beer writer from England. And he was really the first one to travel around Europe and taste beer. And he started to categorize it, to put beers into groups by styles, because mostly, particularly in Belgium, beer styles were not something that people thought about. British beer tasted the way it did. Czech beer tasted the way it did, et cetera, et cetera. And nobody really thought too much about it. And humans love to categorize things.
Yeah, so there's a bit of variations on regionality.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Very much so.
Well, and yeah, and as you say, we do like to put things in sort of boxes. So at that time, what were they just saying, like, it's, this is just English, this is Czech, and it didn't matter if it was a porter or, you know.
Oh, no, no. Porters and stouts and Hefeweizens and pale Bock beers and Pilsners and Helles, all of these things were kind of put together in a book with pictures, beautiful coffee table books that Michael Jackson wrote describing styles of beers, how beer from Belgium differed from beer from Germany and Czech Republic, and for all of the reasons. I mean, there are many reasons why beer is different in, say, in Yorkshire than, say, in Pilsen. There are very specific reasons. Some of them are cultural, but it has mainly to do with two things: the raw materials at hand, what brewers had to deal with, what they had to brew with, and then the government manipulation, taxation mainly. Those two things impacted the taste of beer, how the beer was brewed, and the strength of beer, how much alcohol the beer had. Of course, beer was and is made all over the world. So in the New World, in South America, beer was made with corn. In Africa, mainly made with sorghum, a beer-like beverage. But when we're talking about the type of beer we're talking about, is mainly Northern European beer. So we're talking about Czech tradition, German tradition, Germanic tradition, Belgian tradition, and UK tradition. And Belgium being sort of in the middle of that, they kind of grabbed all of those different, the best of all of those different technologies to come up with their beer. But it really comes down to the raw materials at hand that the brewers had to manipulate, they found over the centuries the best way to brew a beer in their local area so that when you visit a brewery, say not a modern brewery, but say before the 1850s, you could recognize that the brewery, the cooking area, the brew house was designed around the raw materials at hand, how digestible the malt, the barley malt was, for example. And then the cellar where the beer was fermented was designed around the type of yeast that they selected. So
okay.
if you visited an old traditional brewery, maybe a brewery that's 150 years old, you can see how the brewers and engineers manipulated the process to fit the needs of their malt, hops, and yeast. And that is why a Czech lager tastes very different than a London cask ale, for example.
That all makes so much sense. I'm going to open this beer I have on the table because I can't think of a better thing to do while talking about beer than drinking some beer. And so in those days when they're sort of, you know, designing their brew houses, and my guess is it's all going to be pretty much, you know, piecing it together as they can. Are they understanding the yeast they're using? Are they understanding like the raw ingredients and the variations that have, or is it an understanding that's specifically coming through trial and error? Like how much of the science was developed early in that understanding, I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, most of it was done empirically. In other words, by testing. So although the scientific method, the way of studying, running tests to determine, you know, have a hypothesis, run test and have an outcome that you now becomes your truth. That process, the scientific method, is a relatively new idea, but it's been done for thousands and thousands of years. People have always done work to look for cause, to try to say, what would happen if I do this? What would happen if I do that? And then they run a test and they see an outcome and then they test. The difference was before the Great Awakening, say in the middle of the 1800s, which a lot of it came from Germany and England when people started to publish, it was really around the availability of printing presses that people could write books.
Yeah.
Before those times, there were books written about brewing, but not a lot. Mostly brewing was done by guilds, and the guilds held their knowledge very closely so that if a brewer had a way of doing something that people liked and the beer tasted good the way that people liked, they didn't change and they didn't tell anybody. They didn't publish it. And even in Belgium, you see that brewers are very secretive. Mm-hmm. If they have a way of brewing a beer, they're not going to tell anybody. In the modern world, we have trade journals where people will publish and that is a whole culture. And of course, in universities, you publish or die.
Yeah.
But in a historically in breweries, when people figured out a great way to solve a problem, they didn't tell anybody. And the only way that people would find out is if they went to the brewery, maybe they would steal yeast or they would copy ideas. So that is how a lot of the modern Middle European Viennese brewers and Bohemian brewers coming out of that would be, say, Pilsner Urquell. They copied what the British were doing. So there's a story about some very, very well-known Middle European brewers, Germanic brewers from Austria and Munich, traveled to Germany, knocked on doors. I'm sorry, traveled to England, knocked on doors, and because England was the world leader in technology and engineering and brewing, and the breweries that would let them in, they were treated very graciously, and yeah. they stole a lot of stole yeast, literally,
yeah,
and they stole the technology. So the idea of British malting, for example, which the malts, British maltsters were and are probably the best in the world, their technology was copied. So that's another aspect. Industrial espionage is real.
Well, that is funny when you start talking about how these things sort of proliferate, you know, when people start traveling and taking their cool stuff with them to new places, and how you end up with America having almost a more of a strong British brewing history than a German brewing history. Although the state of Wisconsin is probably an outlier in that. It's funny because what you're setting up in the history of this, you know, is the secretiveness of, like, you know, a secret society, right? Like a team of alchemists who are like, we have figured out our stuff. We hold the secrets. And it seems like that's baked into the cake of brewing and baked into the cake of, like, the culture of brewing.
Yes.
You can talk to your other magicians about how you disappear the person or how you know, you sort of saw it, but you'll never give them everything and you're not going to tell the world either.
Yes. And it's funny you use the word alchemy, because alchemy is definitely in Germany, the alchemist insignia is the same as the brewers. It's a fire, water, and earth working together. So it is, alchemy is very, very much part of the tradition of brewing. So it is definitely that creative process pre-published science was trial and error, but that still was science.
So we're drinking a Zwickel right now, which we talked a little bit on the last episode, but we didn't have in the room, and this is one that we released brewery only for the summer. Usually there's a few beers that go brewery only for the summer. And what I've really been digging over the last few summers is there'll be, like, you know, a really well done, what could be classified, we talked about last time, as a beer, you know what I mean? It's not going to be a barrel aged beer. It's not going to be a fruit or a sour beer. It's going to be
beer flavored beer,
a beer flavored beer. So with this beer in particular, and as we're talking about philosophy and brewing, history of brewing, how these things happened, how did this beer come together in history? Like, what's in our glass?
Well, this is Zwickel, and it's tasting, it's, as you said, it's a brewery-only beer. And I really love this label. It's got a barrel on it, and I love the green color. This is our favorite, my favorite label that Deb designed.
And it's tasting really, really good. Yeah. It's got a nice sweet, like, sweet backbone, but it's got a little bit of bitter pop. It's not it's not as bitter as, say, like the Pilsner is, but it's just a very, it's very fast. I'm drinking mine very fast, I think, is the point I'm making.
Yeah, it's very rich and malty, but it has a hoppy backbone to it, so it's not satiating. It's really nice, tasting really good right now. But this is more or less, it actually is unfiltered Edelpils.
Really?
Edelpils was our first beer that we ever brewed. And this, because in those days we had a crappy little beer filter that was always plugging up. And so we came up with a unfiltered version called Zwickel.
That's really cool. And I think it speaks to the sort of philosophy you developed over the years, right? Because, you know, as you're laying out this case of how brewing sort of evolved in the past, and, you know, when you have something good, you kind of, you want to write down the rules. You don't want to change it, right? Like you're saying, if they did something someone liked, they didn't want to change any of it.
Yeah.
But that can breed resistance to change, right? I mean, obviously.
Yes.
So when you're coming around, how prevalent, you know, when you're coming around, you're saying, oh, we have this filter that doesn't quite work, let's make an unfiltered Pilsner, basically. Yeah. How prevalent was that in your beer culture in Wisconsin in 1993 or whatever?
I would say it wasn't very common. In those days, in Wisconsin, there were amber lagers. And so craft beer had to have color in Wisconsin. In the rest of the country, they were mostly pale ales with Cascade hops, for example. So again, amber beers and also dark beers, stouts and porters were what everybody was making. When I was an apprentice brewer and we lived in Germany, the first night we got there was very traumatic, and had a hard time finding a hotel. And we found a place that had... was open, and we got Deb and I and our two girls. We ordered pizza and beer, and they had on draft Budvar from Czech Republic. And both Deb and I were blown away by it. This was in the early 80s, and we thought it was just such a wonderful beer. And so Edelpils and Zwickel are kind of in that same family. And Munich and Budweiss, where the original Budweiser beer came from, Budvar, they're in the same kind of geographic area, more or less. So it's more or less what you might call a Helles style beer.
Yeah.
Malt forward, golden. And so for us to start the brewery and sell a golden colored beer, the most of our customers got it, and they were very happy that we were making that type of beer.
You've always been a guy who's been resistant. Classification just seems to irk you a little bit, right?
Yes, it does. And a lot of brewers, does, because we don't like to be categorized we brew our own beer. I brew my beer. I don't know. It's my beer.
Yeah. So we're talking before about sort of, if we're talking way in the past, it was like, no, that was an English porter, an English stout, an English whatever. Yeah. It was more classifying like that German lager, German Helles or whatever. But with sort of the proliferation of knowledge throughout the 80s, and certainly Jimmy Carter doing his bit by legalizing, home brewing so people can start to experiment, leads to sort of this craft beer thing that gets started.
Yes.
But like a lot of subcultures that get going and are in their nascent, in their nascent stage, you sort of have to define yourself against something, or define yourself in opposition to something, or just like, they wouldn't let us into their club, so we're the outside club now, right? But that also leads to some conformity within a subculture, right?
Very much so.
How was, when you were starting to think about who you are as a brewer, and you start seeing these rigid sort of lines of demarcation start to be formed, because if you have a new market sector, you kind of have to figure out how to market it, but also B, you're not you're kind of against the big guys and what they do. So you automatically have to set up these sort of rules for gatekeeping what craft beer is. How did you develop your own philosophy and style of craft brewing when you start seeing that stuff become more cemented, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, I guess, first of all, it'd be worth saying that you're right that the craft brewing business started really with Jimmy Carter legalizing home brewing. And at that time, there were home brewing textbooks from England. And so the pioneers in craft beer were home brewers that had been trained on what they read in English homebrewing textbooks, when they were all about making traditional English beers, pale ales, porters, and stouts, more or less. So that was, and the German technology or the Czech technology of making lager beer was in a different language. So it was not seen or read by American craft brewers. Plus the equipment, English brewing is eminently beautiful in its simplicity. You just need very simple equipment. The malt, the English malt is the most beautiful, comes from the most beautiful barley in the world. It's easy to work with, simple and rational, fast brewing method. So it's cask ale was generally very inexpensive because it could be made relatively quickly. So it fit well. American malt was designed in such a way that it was conducive to brewing English styles of beer. So it was natural that craft brewers were making that type of beer. And the technology for German beer really, or Czech beer, did not really come about until very recently, when craft beer brewers started to look for alternatives to the standard IPAs, which is originally an English style beer.
Yeah.
And they traveled to Europe and they started to piece this together. There's still a language barrier, but they're starting to piece it together. But it's taken, 30, 40 years for that to happen. But for me, being in Wisconsin, we looked more towards Europe than we did to the West Coast.
Yeah.
Most craft brewers, and in fact, most craft brewers in Europe, this is important, look to the West Coast. So if you go to Germany or England and you go to a craft brewery, they look exactly like American craft breweries. They're brewing American craft beer. totally 100% emulating West Coast IPAs, that style of beer.
Yeah.
And we looked more towards the traditional way. I mentioned the Boudvar brewery, Augustiner brewery, On Dex. All of these breweries were more our inspiration. Orval, Rodenbach, all of these iconic breweries. So we look more towards that tradition. And hence our first beers were golden style lagers.
Yeah.
Not only to differentiate us, but that was the type of beer that Deb and I like to drink. Don't get me wrong. I love a good cask ale in England. I do. And I love a wonderful San Diego or Northern California IPA. I love them, but I wanted to do something different, unique, because as you said, we're somewhat contrary. I have a close relationship with brewers in Germany and Belgium. And that's where so in fact, our brewery is 100% metric. We do everything in metric. The only thing that we do in U.S. units is barrels and cases, because we have to pay taxes on that. But everything else is done by metric. So everybody in the brewery, you know, knows what a meter is, or a centimeter, or a liter, or a hectoliter, or a kilogram, or a gram, because we speak in those terms. So we're very, very much more European centric. So it makes me laugh, because when I talk about mash temperatures, I might say 62 degrees and Americans will Celsius, and Americans will say 144 degrees Fahrenheit. So kind of have to be able to speak multiple languages.
I would be so confused. I'd be like, I don't know. He told me. I guess he's brewing at 62 degrees.
Yeah,
seems
kind of cold.
It seems cold to me, but the man sold a lot of beer. What do I know? Right. What's funny, I'm going to have to get someone in the brewery to teach me the metric system someday.
It's so much easier.
I'm pretty sure that's when I knew I wasn't going to be a scientist.
Yeah.
When they first tried to teach me the metric system, and I just looked at him like stone face. Like, I don't get it. They're like, no, this is like, I don't get it.
Yeah, well, like it's funny, because when Deb is cooking and she's using, say, a European cookbook, and you know, so many grams of this and so many grams of that, she looks at me and says, "How many grams are there in a tablespoon?" you know, so like, what the hell is a tablespoon? I have no idea.
I have no idea. I think a teaspoon's like 5 milliliters, maybe.
Oh, you're better than I am.
Maybe
then.
I had to look that up for some reason not too long ago. Maybe a recipe I needed converting.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. But in any event, but as you're starting up, I mean, you're starting up into a burgeoning craft beer market, and you know you want to be different. But you also know, like, you want to sell the beer too, right?
Yes. So, yeah, sure. You know, that's a good idea.
Yeah, that's a good idea to keep. In order to keep being different, you have to sell.
Exactly. You have to conform.
You have to conform. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. How much pressure was there in those early days to be like, well, do we need to make a this so that it frees up room for that? Do you kind of get what I'm?
It was huge.
It was huge pressure.
It was huge. We'll just leave it at that.
Gotcha. Well, sometimes it's good to be angry about stuff. Yeah. I mean, you know, it is what it is. But
you'd be a good psychoanalyst for me then. It's okay that you're angry. Go ahead and yell.
I was seeing one of those not too long ago, and I was like, I think I need a new one. Every time I say something that I think is completely crazy, he goes, I understand. I can see how you got there. I'm like, you can see how I got there. I know I'm nuts. How can I'm paying you to tell me when I'm going crazy.
Yeah, like, right.
I don't trust you anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
No, he was a good guy. But anyway, so as you get into your career and you start being solidified, you know who you are, you know what you want to do, you know how to do it. What started getting you thinking about what kind of brewer you wanted to be?
It all comes down to the taste.
Yeah.
So if I say if I'm sitting in a beer hall in Munich and I'm having a Helles, and the beer goes, the half liter Stein goes empty too quickly, it's like that's the type of beer that I want to brew. So I looked at certainly we make double IPAs and I love that style of beer, but my point is that I looked at all of the different, traveled and talked to experts. I have friends that are recognized experts in all of these countries. And I asked them lots of questions. Why this? Why that? And out of these investigations and tastings and communications, I latched on to the touchstones that are important to me, because brewers have touchstones. They have things that are immutable that they have to do. And that becomes important to their brewing process. And every decision you make, it's not a linear, it has an impact. It's things in brewing are not linear. They're more like a spider web. So there's not like a cause and an effect, a cause and effect. Each of those is connected in a spoke, like a wheel or a spider web. And when you change one side, it has a ripple effect everywhere else. And then you start to react to correct things to keep the boat righted, if that makes sense. So I've taken pieces of puzzles from different groups. Why would you do that? Well, we do it because it has a more complex taste. It makes for a unique taste. So again, if you taste the beers of Munich versus the beers of Milwaukee, they taste different. Yeah. And that's part of the reason.
That makes so much sense to me, because when you think about, you know, how can you best extract what you're looking for from an ingredient, right? Like, say you're trying to extract, I don't know, sugar from onions, right?
Yep.
Whatever, to caramelize your onions. Now you can do it low and you can do it low and slow, really pull them out, then crank up the heat and really hit it. But it's like, well, that takes an hour or so. Well, what if you do it on medium? You add a little bit of water and then you put a lid on and the steam creates it. And then, yeah, sure, the onions will go a little limper, but will you really notice? Will the flavor won't be as complex, but will you really notice? And you're just trying to get it done now. And it's like,
yes,
there's all like technology can always get you, I guess, from A to B quicker. But what do you lose? Like, I always wonder, what do you lose in the process, right? Even if it's just like a fraction of, you know, a depth of flavor, or you strip an essential mineral or an essential vitamin from a piece of food because you needed to get it from raw to cooked a little bit faster. Am I making any sense?
No, you're making 100%. It's spot on that what you're talking about is the subtleties of flavor versus the cost. And so the danger is that when you do these sorts of things, and you can, I want to do it more quickly, not always, but sometimes, many times, the flavor is diminished and you may not be able to notice it.
Yeah.
It may not be statistically relevant. You might be able to not pick it up in taste panel, and you might want to have a bias to want to say that it's different. Or the kiss of death, the worst thing that brewers, no brewer should ever say, the customer will never notice. So the thing I guess that I'm trying to say is that when you make all of these small changes, collectively they make a difference, because once you have an appetite for, let's say, cutting corners or economizing, you start down a slippery slope. And you know, there's one great iconic national beer that I know really, really well. And there's been a 20-25 year change in that beer. Tweak in order to improve profitability. The beer from 25 years ago was, in my opinion, at least as an old timer, was eminently better than the modern beer. I'm very disappointed when I drink this beer.
Yeah.
So it is a dangerous thing to do. So we try to go the other way. We try to say, how can we make this beer better, subtly better, small things? So if we're going to, you know, cook the onions in the correct way, and it's more expensive, takes more energy, takes more time, but it makes for a better product because our customers are buying our beer. They're paying a premium for our beer over the national shippers, and so they expect it to be better. And so there's lots of things we do, like decoction mashing, boiling the mash.
Yeah.
It's nobody does that anymore, at least in the United States. And there is, you know, one very well-known professor that says it's absolute lunacy to even do this. It's a waste of time. It's not useful. Well, have you ever tasted beer in Prague? Have you ever tasted fresh lager beer in Prague? That's made with a double or a triple decoction. Have you tasted that versus Carling, a black label in England, which is made with an infusion mash? Can you taste the difference? If you can't, well, you know what? You're right.
Yeah.
But I can taste the difference. So I'm thank you very much, but I'm going to use decoction. It's not going to make a huge difference for sure, but it makes enough difference that it's a valuable tool to have in your toolbox. So, or long lagering. You don't need the lager. We lager our beers for 6, 7, 8 weeks, depending on the beer. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Because you can do it in days. You can do it in 7 days. You can do it with warm temperatures. You can do it with the use of enzymes. You have to step up your filtration process to get the beer to be clear. So there are many, many ways to cut the corner and do it faster. The beer will taste different. It will taste different. I'm sorry.
But you can't change things in beer and have it not taste different. That seems to be like a through course. Line. That's like a true...
Flavor is just so subtle. If maddeningly small changes can have huge effects.
Yeah, it really can. So, and so, you know, as we're talking about when you sort of, you know, when you sort of form these, the dogmatic sort of clubs, and then when you sort of position yourself as like, hey, you know, I'm just looking for the best flavor I can get. I'm just looking for the best beer I can get. What is the reaction sort of to that when you're saying, well, I'm going to take a check, you know, and you know, these days it's probably a little more open and free because, you know, back in the day, someone probably wasn't like, well, you put a bunch of barley flake in my IPA. What's going on here? But what is the reaction when it's like, oh, I'm gonna marry Czech and German pilsners or whatever it is. I'm just gonna mash these together.
That's what we did with Nuglers Pilsner. But it's important I think maybe I'm sounding a little bit smug and trying to be superior, and
well,
it's
I don't
really
think so.
Not my intent, because when I say what's best, that's completely 100% subjective.
Yeah.
And it's really up to the customers to decide. But there are many, many breweries that have completely different philosophies than me and make superb beer. So the way I do things is a stylistic thing, just like a musician or, like you said, like a chef. So it doesn't mean that what I'm doing is better. It just means that I'm owning what I want to do. And so Deb and I will often taste food or taste beer or taste wine or whatever, whiskey, and talk about what we like and what we don't like. And Deb is what's called a super taster, meaning she has a really, really great palate. And so do my daughters. Both of them are really superb palates.
So, Kate can smell things from like upstairs. It's insane.
Yeah. That's what I mean by a super taster.
Yeah.
And, oftentimes they're women, but not always. We will find things, flavors that we like and we think are important, and then we'll put them out in the world. So we'll try something, and then it's up to the customers to vote. So we don't advertise. So everything is people vote with their pocketbooks. So we know very quickly which beers are selling well, and so we tweak and move towards what people want to buy. So we have to get it through to them onto the shelf. I say that the customers decide, but the beer has to be put in front of them. And that's a problem nowadays. And that's why you don't see many large craft breweries anymore, and why they're all tap rooms or brew pubs, because access to market is tightly controlled through the pinch point of wholesale and retail. There's only so much shelf space.
Yeah.
There's only so much, as Anheuser-Busch used to say, share of mind with the wholesalers. They can only sell so much beer.
They can only keep so much stuff in their heads you mention this? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. If you have 200 IPAs in your portfolio, which I think is very possible, you can't get in front of everybody. But if you can get the beer in front of people, the customers will vote very quickly. And with social media, they'll let us know too.
Well, that all makes a lot of sense. And when we're talking about before, you know, sort of, you know, with souring the wort to decrease, let me see if I can get this correct with my recall, to decrease alkalinity and pH.
Yes.
There we go. To decrease alkalinity and pH. And saying, you know, people, why would you do that? They sell this product, they sell that product. You know, we can show you on a chart and a graph how much more efficient it'll be, blah, blah, blah. All the things that people say to get you to buy the jug or the whatever.
Yeah.
What I think people always forget to try to quantify or try to at least, because I don't think you can quantify it, but you should at least keep it in your mind, is there has to be a measurable impact on the quality of a good when the producer of that good is doing it in a way that makes them feel good about what they're doing. Huh. Makes them feel like they are doing the proper way that they want to do it in.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to lace up or suit up to go to a job to be like, well, I got this guy above me telling me I have to do it this way. So I'm just going to push the button. I'm going to turn the crank and I'm going to punch out and I'm not going to think about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but if you're allowed the freedom to explore different stylists, different ways to combine styles, different ways to combine techniques, and it may be longer, it may be shorter. I have to believe you're punching in every day, you know, excited to taste what that was like.
Well, you're kind of alluding to a spiritual aspect of manufacturing, which to get a little bit kind of frou-frou here, there's a word and I forget it, unfortunately. Maybe somebody who's listening who speaks Japanese could remind me, but there's a word in Japanese for the imprint that any manufactured good has from the maker. So the energy that comes from the maker is instilled into this object, whatever it is. And there's, you know, lots of different philosophies that everything has an energy and et cetera. But more importantly, my point is that how you feel about what you're making, the people who are actually making it, all the way, the farmers, all the way to the people on the bottling line or canning line, have an impact on that energy. And I firmly believe that to be true. So you want to feel good about what you're doing. You want to feel that what you're doing is not only adding value to the universe, but is good and honest.
Yeah. And I think that carries through on the consumer side too, because, like, you know, you pick whatever fast food joint you think in your head when I say like fast food joint that you just have to eat at one day or whatever. Like, you go there and you get sustenance. It might taste good. It might not taste good, or it tastes passable, whatever. But I very rarely do you leave it feeling like, oh yeah, I felt like I did something good just now. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
It doesn't feel like any part of that process was done in like a way of how can we all enjoy what we're doing right now? And it feels like when you're talking about beer, when you're talking about, you know, the conformity of what craft beer is, how to play within those lines, how to color outside those lines, how to take best practices or just techniques and marry them. What you're really talking about is sort of being outside of the group and just looking at it from a 10,000 view, a 10,000 foot view, and just saying
analytically,
what rings true to me about what everybody is
exactly.
doing. Does that make any sort of sense?
Oh yeah. It's 100% how I view it. Is it Groucho Marx who said I wouldn't want to belong to any, any club that would want me as a member?
Yeah. The only rule to my club is you can't want to be in my club.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want to get in, you're out. We don't. Yeah. You don't. I think it's an old Bill, the old Bill Hicks bit, the people who ate people club.
Yeah, the antisocial social club.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing, Bill? That sounded too nice. You're out.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yep.
Well, is there any other points you want to touch on sort of your philosophy of brewing, or sort of how you view the utilization of techniques, regardless of how it fits to style or how it, you know, how it could be viewed by whoever, I guess.
Well, when you ferment beer, you produce lots and lots and lots of CO2. Most of it's vented. But to carbonate the beer, it's really effing simple. When the beer is nearly done fermenting and still bubbling, you just close the tank and build some pressure.
Yeah.
And of course, it's a little bit extra work, just like you said about your onions.
Yeah.
But the beer is naturally carbonated. And it's relatively easy to do with lager beer because lager beer is made cold and CO2 is dissolves better when the beer is cold. So lager beer it's a no-brainer to naturally carbonate the beer. And the beer is 100% naturally carbonated.
Yeah.
But now, here we are 30, 40 years later, I'm starting to see craft brewers talking about, you know, trying to buy valves. They call them spunding valves, but it's really called spunting yeah. valves to naturally carbonate. You put a back pressure on your tank so that you can naturally carbonate the beer. So it's finally starting to come into view for craft brewers because people are starting to finally understand German technology to make naturally carbonated beer, which is, I think you don't need to be a food scientist to understand that it's a superior way to carbonate your beer. Just like the difference between champagne made by the traditional method or the bulk method where it's injected with carbon dioxide and you can buy it, you know, for $5 a bottle versus $150 a bottle.
Well, that is so interesting because when you think about stuff like that, right, you take a process that it naturally it wants to do it. If you just,
naturally
it wants to do it. And I just think in my head, like, you know, if something naturally wants to do the thing you're forcing it to do, just sort of let it naturally do its thing.
Yeah.
But, and I'm not smart. I'm not like a scientist. I couldn't tell you why I believe what I'm about to say, but I kind of think I believe it. And I just started believing it like a second ago. But say you take a beer and you like inject carbonation into it, right? I have to believe something is happening in there yeah. with the pressure and the force that it's coming in and whatever picked up from the outside is being injected. Who knows how that actually affects like the structure on like under a microscope level of the beer.
That's true. Where
if you just sort of put the thing and close it up and let it do what it wants to do, it seems like it'd be a much softer process. And I always think soft processing of any sort of raw ingredient is usually going to lead to a better outcome.
Well,
right?
You say something really important that's philosophically important to me is to let things do what they want to do. I often say when we face problems in the brewery, scientific issues or things that we can't figure out, whatever, or even mechanical issues, I often say, I think the yeast or the equipment or the process, the world is trying to tell us something and we just can't understand because they're yelling to us, this is what you need to do. And you need to stop and listen. It's like your dog or your cat.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you can tell when your dog or your cat is just like really trying hard to tell you something, but you just don't understand.
Just don't have the words.
And so you have to stop and really think about this. And sometimes, like you say, the most elegant solution is the simplest, natural, easy solution.
Yeah, it was funny. I was trying to teach my son this concept, and we were watching a lot of Ghostbuster cartoons. And we'd watch the movies.
Perfect thing for a four-year-old and his dad to do.
Exactly. He was really into the movies, so we started watching cartoons. In the movie, Slimer is like, you know, he hits Bill Murray. He's a ghost. They bust him, and they get out. But in the show, he's like their friend. He's like, why are they hanging out with Slimer? I'm like, you know, man, I think they just came to realize that's, if you're going to hang out with Slimer, you're going to get slime. That's just what he does.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, honestly, he just wants to eat stuff. I think they think he's cool.
That's funny.
So it's like trying to teach him like, just let things be, let people be. And unless like offensive to you or harmful to you, then who
like
cares?
The John Lennon song, Let It Be.
Yeah, let Slimer be Slimer. Let your beer carbonate by itself. They both want to do the things they do.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Dan, we're hitting about an hour. And
oh, my God, that was a long one.
Yeah, this has just been a super fun conversation. I feel like we could just keep talking about this stuff and then just keep coming up with more out there examples for how we should just like let things exist.
Yeah, exactly.
But thank you very much for your time, Dan.
All right, thank you, Scott.